tenor Mark Padmore and pianist Julia Streich performing Schubert's final song, a setting of the poet Zeigel, Die Taubenpost, about a homing pigeon who faithfully carries the poet's words of love and tears to the beloved and always comes back. And then the singer reveals at the end that the carrier pigeon is in fact longing. Mark Padmore was saying earlier how all of these late Schubert songs written in the last 3 years of his life actually feel rather more like choral music than solo songs to him. How his voice is perhaps one of the inner parts weaving in and out of the piano. Much loved and ever popular artists here at London's Wigmore Hall, Mark Padmore and Julia Streich, who take this same programme off to Spain next. Well, next week's Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert features the Trio di Clarone and the pianist Kalle Randalou performing Mendelssohn, Bruch and Schumann. But as the audience here at Wigmore Hall departs, time for me to hand you on to Broadcasting House in London.
And that concert was presented by Sarah Moore-Peach. And from London and the early part of the 19th century, time now on BBC Radio 3 to head for York for music from a much earlier era. Special edition of the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the National Centre for Early Music here in York for today's live early music show. We have an audience with us here who are agog for all things Renaissance, Restoration and Rococo. And over the next couple of weeks or so, this is the place to be. Am I right?
Yes!
Well rehearsed. Yes, the York Early Music Festival is now officially underway, and we've got a stellar lineup of musical guests to delight and dazzle you over the next hour. As usual, we're joined by Delma Tomlin, director of the National Centre for Early Music, to talk us through some of the highlights of this year's festival. I'll also be chatting to Andrew Parrott, who's about to be awarded the fifth biennial York Early Music Festival Lifetime Achievement Award. And we'll have live music from baritone Matthew Brook and keyboard player Peter Seymour, two cellists in the form of duo Domenico, and three ladies from France who go by the name of Amaryllis. And this is them now, with two movements of a trio sonata by Jean-Marie Leclerc.
Thank you.
Well, that was some very jolly recorder playing, wasn't it? I like that. Part of Trio Sonata in D by the 18th century French composer Jean-Marie Leclerc, played by three members of the ensemble Amaryllis: Eloise Gaillard on the recorder, the gamba player Marianne Mourier, and on harpsichord Violaine Gauchard, performing live here at the National Centre for Early Music. And we'll be hearing from them again at the end of the programme. So, this year's York Early Music Festival is now very much underway. In fact, you may have heard a couple of live in concerts on Radio 3 earlier this week. Jordi Savall's Hesperion 21 on Thursday and the 16 from York Minster on Friday, which, by the way, they're still available to listen again on the iPlayer if you missed them. So, Delma Tomlin, director of the festival, what are the themes you've decided to focus on this year?
Good afternoon, Lucy. First and foremost, it's a treat to have you back in York.
I'm a bit of a regular.
You're a bit of a regular, darling, as a performer and obviously as a presenter. The themes are two essentially very contrasting themes, beautifully, although I would say so myself, intertwined. The Spanish theme is the warmth, the Catholic intensity of music, and that contrasts really with a whole series of anniversaries based around C.P. Bach's anniversary, of that what you might think is a rather more cool Protestant northern climes. But actually, as we're learning, C.P. Bach is anything other than cool and unemotional. And we had last night his Passion, and it was extraordinary. I mean, for those who don't know C.P. Bach's music, and why, in a way, we don't, it's wonderful music. So actually, it's Passion all round.
So some familiar things and some new things to learn as well, as
Absolutely.
Always at York, I
Absolutely.
Must say.
Absolutely, that's of course the idea. Absolutely.
Well, one of the things we like to do from time to time in the early music world, and I know you do too, is to extend the boundaries a little, sort of looking at music from, say, different cultures, researching the earliest music we can find, maybe, or kind of pushing it past even what some people think is the early music cut-off point. And our next live music does just that. It's a German song by Carl Friedrich Zelter, written in 1804. It's sung here right now by Matthew Brook with Peter Seymour at the forte piano.
Am Abgrund leidet der schwindliche Steg, erfährt zwischen Leben und Sterben. Es sperren die Riesen den einsamen Weg und drohen dir ewig Verderben. Und willst du die schlafende Löwin nicht wecken, so wandle still durch die Straße der Schrecken. Es Eine Brücke hoch über den Rand der furchtbaren Tiefe gebogen. Sie war nicht erbaut von Menschenhand, es hatte sich keine verwogen. Der Strom braust unter ihr spät und früh, speit ewig hinauf und zertrümmert. Öffnet sich schwarz ein schauriges Tor, du glaubst dich im Reiche der Schatten. Da tut sie ein lachend Gelände hervor, wo der Herbst und der Frühling sich gatten. Aus des Lebens Mühen und ewige Qual möcht ich fliehen, fliehen. Möcht ich fliehen in dieses glückselige Tal. Vier Ströme brausen hinab in das Feld, ihr Quelle ist ewig verborgen. Sie fließen nach allen vier Straßen der Welt, nach Abend und Mittag und Morgen. Und wie die Mutter sie rauschend geboren, fortfliehen sie und bleiben sich ewig verloren.
allen Geschlechtern drauf tanzen umschleiert mit goldenem Duft die Wolken, die himmlischen Töchter. Sie halten dort oben den einsamen Rhein, da stellt sich kein Zeuge, kein Irrlicher ein. Es sitzt die Königin hoch und klar auf unvergänglichem Throne. Die Stirn umkränzt sie sich wunderbar mit diamantener Krone. Drauf schließt die Sonne die Pfeile von Licht, die vergolden sie nun und erwärmen sie nicht.
Lead by Carl Friedrich Zelter, the baritone Matthew Brook with pianist Peter Seymour. And Peter, thank you for arriving here so promptly at the microphone so we can have a little chat. Now, you and Matthew gave a concert in York here yesterday, didn't you?
Two concerts.
Yes,
not at the same time.
No. How did they go?
Well, we did that song and the next one that we're doing, plus, that was 8 minutes of the hour. We had five singers who were singing the evening concert in the C.P. Bach cantata. And I thought, well, they've got not much to do in the evening, so we better find something else for them as well. And so I devised a programme of the sort of thing that would have been sung at the Berlin Singakademie, which Zelter was one of the instigators of. He was the composer of that last piece, written in 1804. And he was a very important... is a wonderful composer, you just heard, and there's a lot of songs, many that we don't know because they're not readily available, and I imagine that's one of them, indeed. But he was very important as a teacher and as an encourager. So he taught, for example, Mendelssohn, Fanny Hensel, Mendelssohn's sister, Loewer, who we're about to hear, and various other people. And the programme is the sort of thing they might have sung for an end-of-term concert, they've been practising all term, as we have been doing. And it was the result of our term's practice in the morning. It was a rather informal affair, and they sang part songs. They did Earl Koenig settings by Reichardt, also an anniversary composer, and Zelter, where we had four singers rather than the usual one. I very much enjoy doing programmes with several singers and only one pianist.
I was talking before about how what we call early music is right. Beginning to cover a much broader range of repertoire these days. But as you say, with that song dating from the early 19th century, I wonder if that's kind of pushing it a bit. After all, as you say, Zelter did teach Mendelssohn. You can't really get less Baroque than that. I mean, how do you justify calling that early music?
Well, about Schubert, for example, his... late cycles, Winterreiser and Schöne Mühlen, they were written for an early piano, 1795 piano, I'm sure, because that's the compass he uses. Of course, his piano pieces and quintets and so on, like the Trout, they were written for a bigger piano with an octave above at the top, as this one has. This is an 1820 copy of a Fritz, again a Viennese instrument, and it has the extra sort of mystical or magical mythical octave at the top, as you will partly hear in the next concert, but also has a wonderful depth, a different depth to the it goes down three or four, five notes lower than the 1795 piano. But Loewer, the song we're going to do, was written 1732, I think, and It took him a while to write it. and he was clearly writing for an early piano. He couldn't afford. He was writing for 1821. It wasn't yet one of the Broadwoods that people like Chopin were then writing on. But, I mean, that's early music. It's to do with the style and the approach to it. But there's no doubt you can hear with this 1820 piano, which is, I think, the sort that Loewe was writing for, probably till the end of his life. We did another piece from 1860, just before he died yesterday, Tom de Reimer, a Scottish ballad, which is exactly the same sort of thing that Schubert was writing. I'm sure Schubert's a classical composer, or is certainly classically based, but moving forward. I mean, Beethoven's a slightly different, well, a very different character, of course.
I know you're going to play a piece, as you said, by Loewe in a moment. It's kind of a ghostly song, Die Nächtliche Heerschau.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us what it's about? I've got a translation here, but maybe you should
say
it.
Well, it's the idea is it's hearing an army in fact, a dead army, so all we're hearing is these ghostly sounds in the distance, and eventually the commander wakens up and he says, "Frankreich, France," and they reply, "St. Helena." So it's all in the imagination, and it suits the piano beautifully. You'll hear it starts with a very ghostly sound, which this sort of piano can produce, and a later piano can't. They were writing for early sounds, and that's why it fits in to an early music show.
Brilliant, thank you
live.
So much. Absolutely brilliant. You've justified it really well, Peter. Okay, if you want to pop back the piano and join Matthew Brook there, and we're going to hear... Carl Loewe's song, which has just been described, the ghostly song of the Night Parade.
Nachts die zwölfte Stunde verlässt Tambour sein Grab. Mit der Trommel die Runde geht wirbelnd auf und ab. Mit seinem entfleischten Armen rührt die Schlagen zugleich. Schlägt manchen guten Wirbel, Rehen und Zapfenstreich. Die Trommel klingelt seltsam, hat gar einen starken Ton. Die alten toten Soldaten erwachen im Grabe davon. Und die im tiefen Norden erstarrt in Schnee und Eis. Und die in Welschland liegen, wo ihnen die Erde zu heiß. Und die der Nilschlamm decket, und ihr arabischer Sand. Sie steigen aus den Gräbern und nehmen's Gewehr zur Hand. Da kommen auf luftigen Pferden die toten Reiter herbei, die blutigen alten Schwadronen in Waffen mancherlei. Und die zwölfte Stunde verlässt Feldherr sein Grab, kommt langsam hergeritten, umgeben von seinen Stab. Trägt ein kleines Hütchen, trägt ein einfach Kleid. Und einen kleinen Degen trägt an seiner Seite. Der Mond mit gelben Lichte erhellt den weiten Plan. Der Mann im kleinen Hütchen sieht sich die Truppen an. Der Feldherr sagt
die Nelsen ins Ohr ein Wörtchen leis. Das Wort geht in die Runde, klingt wieder fern und nah. Frankreich heißt die Parole, die Losung Sankt Helena. Das ist die große Parade im Elyseischen Feld, die um die zwölfte Stunde der tote Cäsar hält.
Wonderfully theatrical Matthew Brook, the baritone there with Peter Seymour at the forte piano in that 19th century song, The Night Parade by Carl Lerver, which perhaps rather stretches the boundaries of what we might call early music, but as Peter explained earlier, nevertheless has kind of earned its place, I think, in the festival. You're listening to the Early Music Show here on BBC Radio 3. I'm Lucy Skeeping. And today we're live at the National Centre for Early Music in York as part of this year's York Early Music Festival. Now, every 2 years, the festival gives a prestigious Lifetime Achievement Award to someone who spent their career working tirelessly in the field of early music. Previous winners have been Bartold Kuchen, Dame Emma Kirkby, James Bowman and Jordi Savall. And later on in the programme, I'm going to be talking to this year's winner, the founder and director of the Taverner Consort Choir and Players, Andrew Parrott.
Thank you.
gorgeous, melting musical texture. Antonio Lotti's 10-part Crucifixus, a 1991 recording by the Taverner Choir, directed by Andrew Parrott, who's going to join me in person on this live early music show from the York Early Music Festival in just a few minutes' time. Before that, though, we're going to have some more live music, and we're lucky to have not one but two cellists here at the National Centre for Early Music, and they're all strung up and ready to roll. Jonathan Rees and Vladimir Waltham, who go by the name together of Duo Domenico. They're in York for a concert this Tuesday afternoon, where they're going to be playing a selection of pieces by Boccherini against a backdrop of those musicians who influenced his style, including the 18th century Italian composer and cello virtuoso Stefano Galeotti. The first movement of Stefano Galeotti's Cello Sonata in D Major, Opus 1, Number 3, played for us live here at the National Centre for Early Music by Duo Domenico. And the two cellists in question are, well, they've just... I was going to say you were making your way over to the table, but you're here now. Thank you so much, Vladimir Waltham and Jonathan Rees, for joining me. Now, you were the winners of the Young Artists Award at last year's festival. I'm not surprised. Your technique's extraordinary. I'm very impressed. You were most of the time halfway up the fingerboard, at least one of you. I'm guessing it's been quite a busy year for you after that.
It's been fairly busy. I mean, we had, in the build-up to the competition, we'd organised quite a few concerts for ourselves, but having won the prize meant that actually quite a few people contacted us to get us to play in concerts. Some of them eventually didn't happen, but we have had quite a few.
That's showbiz.
Yes. We've had a few since, and it's been lots of fun learning ever more rap.
We had a lot of fun at a little festival I happened to organise in Bristol as well, where we played quite a number of Boccherini and Galeotti sonatas.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah, I was wondering about how much repertoire there sort of is for two cellos, but... I guess you make your own arrangements too, do you?
Well, there's an enormous amount of repertoire, particularly given that there was a tradition of cellists accompanying cellists in place of a keyboard instrument in the middle of the 18th century.
So tell us a little bit more about this Boccherini-inspired concert that you've got coming up in the festival here in a couple of days' time, I think. Who was Stefano Galeotti? Sounds like a fashion designer to me.
Maybe he
have been as well. Who
Boccherini
was
Boccherini met Casanova, apparently. So, I mean, this is the world that they all moved in. Yeah.
But can you sort of trace anything about his life? Is there anything out there?
Well, apparently Galeotti was born in Livorno, that's about as much as the Grove will tell us, and lived most of his life in Holland. John will tell you more, he was telling me about him.
Boccherini probably heard him in Lucca, which is where Boccherini's from, when Boccherini was but a young child still. But then when Boccherini moved to Vienna as a cellist, accompanied by his father, where he was playing a lot of the Boccherini sonatas, Galeotti was employed also in Vienna with a salary three times higher than Boccherini's. He was 20 years older than Boccherini, so you can well imagine that Boccherini emulated his style and very much looked up to him.
Mm. We were speculating the other day whether Boccherini might have been inspired to play the cello from hearing Galeotti play in Lucca. Of course, that's completely speculation, but we thought it would be quite fun.
Well, we're going to hear some more Galeotti now, so maybe if you'd like to just sort of take your seats by those beautiful Baroque cellos over there you've been playing, without a spike, by the way, for those of you who can't see, because they're held sort of above the ground somehow by magic, not balloons. So this is Galeotti's Sonata in D Major, the second movement, and it's played live here in York by Duo Domenico.
Thank you.
Two cellos there, although one of them did sound quite like a violin at times. The second movement from Stefano Galeotti's Sonata for Cellos in D major, played by duo Domenico, Vladimir Waltham and Jonathan Rees. Thanks to both of them for coming to play for us. And I know Jonathan's having to jump straight into a cab now to head across the city to rehearse with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, who have a concert here in York tonight. I guess he'll have to get used to being in demand. Now, while the applause for that last piece just now was ringing around this rather pretty stone hall here at the National Centre for Early Music, a special guest has managed to sneak into position at my table. I mentioned earlier that Andrew Parrott was going to put in an appearance, and here he is. Andrew, welcome. Thanks for joining me. Now, this is actually an important day for you, isn't it? Because shortly after we come off the air this afternoon, you're going to be presented with an award from the York Early Music Festival, a Lifetime Achievement Award, no less. It's brilliant to be honoured in such a way. Congratulations. It sounds a little bit Hollywood, dare I say. I wonder if it makes you feel rather old.
The lifetime word is slightly the downside of the thing, the achievement thing. I'm rather looking forward to discovering what it is I'm meant to have achieved. So there's a positive.
Oh, modesty. But you have had a very impressive long career, there's no doubt about that. I must stress so far. Most people will associate you with the Taverner Consort Choir and Players, of course, which celebrated its 40th anniversary last year. But you've also been involved with other ensembles, haven't you?
Yes, I wander around from place to place, and I must admit it has been really enjoyable, particularly, I suppose, in more recent years, discovering groups in different countries around Europe and in North America particularly, that are dealing with the same repertory, the same issues, but are at a different point. And technically, they may be wonderfully far advanced, much further perhaps than we were for 30 years ago or something, but inevitably so, because the cumulative benefit of all the experience has really reached. But what these groups often have, in addition, is a hunger and curiosity, which I think is absolutely wonderful, so it keeps me, I hope, relatively young in spirit, if not in flesh.
So you go in and sort of help direct them, conduct them, give them some masterclass?
I just have fun. I just really like working with a group, any group, that is wanting to improve or learn more, experiment, and that means I can play positively and learn myself.
Well, we're going to talk more in a few moments, but I think it's time we heard you in action again, so to speak. This is another of your recordings with the Taverner Players, quite an early one, from 1989 this time, and it's part of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2. I shall have to stop myself humming along.
Thank you.
third movement of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 in F in a 1989 recording by the Taverner Players, directed by Andrew Parrott, who's with me here at the National Centre for Early Music in New York. Andrew, the Lifetime Achievement Award you're about to be presented with this afternoon does certainly reflect a long and illustrious career. In fact, we go back quite a long way, don't we? Because we worked together back in 19... something like that, on the Florentine Intermedi, if I recall, at Smith Square. Oh, and one or two other things. Has the early music scene changed a lot, in your opinion, over the last 40 years?
Enormously. One has to ask whether it's for better or for worse. I mean, some things are for better and some things are not necessarily for better. I mean, it has, I suppose, if you like, become mainstream, or at least a subcategory of mainstream. And that brings with it commercial pressures and, I mean, in a way, the success... Well, I don't judge success by the number of concerts or number of recordings there are, but by the sort of quality of understanding that goes into those performances. So in certain respects, we've been successful in clarifying certain ideas and principles, and it's wonderful to hear and see younger players and singers benefiting from that. It is sad to see them being, I mean, because there are so many of them, and because there has been this commercial success, there is greater competition amongst them, and therefore there is a pressure, not necessarily apparent, but a pressure on them to concentrate on selling, marketing, and doing something to make themselves interesting. They don't have the leisure, and sometimes don't have the curiosity that I think is vital to explore these things, because we know an awful lot, but there's still so much in any of these repertories, which are now accessible in sound, that we don't understand. And I just hope that we never lose that curiosity and also the circumstances in which that we can explore, because we just have to do, if we're not careful, we just turn out a performance rather than have the time to sit back and think about what it is that we're performing. Because we, as performers, I think, and it sounds terribly sort of, pompous, I suppose, I think as a performer, particularly as a conductor, I have a duty to represent the composer as best as I can, not just in technical accuracy, but in understanding what it is that made that piece work and what it is that made the composer write that piece. We may get it completely wrong, but if we stop asking those questions, the performances, however neat and tidy they may be, will not really do the job for me personally.
Well, I'm absolutely right, and I look forward to the next 40 years. Thanks very much for joining us this afternoon, and congratulations on the award. We're going to hear another of your recordings now, a recent reissue, in fact, of your 1994 CD of Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. I have to admit, I remember this particularly well, as I was there myself singing the part of one of the witches. Typecast, I know. But we really had a good time on that. I think it does show through, and we're going to come in on the very last part of the work. It's absolutely gorgeous, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Lucy.
last part of Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, the Taverner Choir and Players, directed by Andrew Parrott, who I must say hasn't aged at all. And I hope his Lifetime Achievement Award includes a shiny object that he can put on his mantelpiece. Right, well, we have our last bit of music in today's programme coming up shortly, and we're going to end where we began, with the French ensemble Amaryllis. Now, Colleen Vandenberg, you're the manager of the ensemble. I know that the three performers aren't very confident in their English, although I think they're probably not as bad as they say. Anyway, you're valiantly stepping in to talk to us on their behalf. Now, how did their concert go yesterday in the festival?
Well, actually, I'm not sure if it's to me, to us, to answer. I think we should ask the beautiful audience of the York Early Music Festival. But I think it did go very well, and the musicians were very happy about the response of the audience. I guess the French music played by French musicians is not done as often in England anyway. But the musicians were very happy also and moved to be there because they exist now since 20 years. It's the 20th anniversary this year. And actually 1 year later, after the creation, they came to York and they won the prize of the competition here. So it was 19 years later they came back, and I think they really enjoyed that.
So they got a bit of a fan base here.
Yeah,
we heard music by Leclerc earlier on, who died 250 years ago this year, in fact, and now we're going to hear Amaryllis play a couple of pieces by Rameau, who also died the same year. Do you think it's important to mark these anniversaries? I mean, we certainly do quite a lot of that on the BBC. I guess it is one way of making sure we sort of remember musicians at a certain point.
Well, we talked about it with the girls, and basically what is important is that there is a lot of pieces which are not very well known for the audience, and maybe these anniversaries permit to rediscover pieces which are never played, not edited. So I guess it's a way to, permit these unknown pieces to be heard and heard live. And I think in France, I mean, the Leclerc and Rameau anniversary was very huge because it's our Baroque stars.
Well, let's hear some music then. This is Ensemble Amaryllis with two movements from the second suite by Rameau. And thank you very much for talking to me. Thank you. From Rameau's second suite, played live here at the National Centre for Early Music by Ensemble Amaryllis. Eloise Gaillard, this time on the oboe, Marianne Muller on viola da gamba, and Violaine Cochard on the harpsichord. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's edition of the Early Music Show, which has come to you live from the York Early Music Festival. Thanks very, very much to all my guests for performing so beautifully for us, Ensemble Amaryllis, Duo Domenico, Matthew Brook and Peter Seymour. Thanks to Andrew Parrott for talking to us about his Lifetime Achievement Award, which he'll be receiving straight after we go off the air, I gather. And, of course, to the energetic lady who puts it all together each year, the festival director, Delma Tomlin. And thank you to the live audience, you out there, for being so responsive to all things early. Same time next year, yep. Hooray. It's a date then. Bye-bye.
The Early Music Show, live from York, was presented by Lucy Skeeping. This is BBC Radio 3. We turn our attention next to all things choral. In just under an hour from now, Sarah Moore-Peach presents this week's edition of The Choir. Sarah's here to look ahead, and it's very much schools out, really, for the summer break this week.
Absolutely. It's the last of the season before we come back after the proms in September. So for that, we thought we'd look ahead on The Choir today to lots of the choral events that are taking place over the summer across the UK. And in fact, if anyone has a choral event they're taking part in that they'd like us to know about, then there is still time to get in touch. You can text us on 83111 or get in touch on Twitter at BBC Radio 3. And the other thing that we're focusing on is Riga. If you were listening to Music Matters yesterday, you've heard Tom Service in Riga, capital of culture, mentioning the World Choir Games, which started as the Choral Olympics and is absolutely gargantuan. It's the most epic competition of choirs.
What sort of numbers are we talking about?
We're talking choirs from 60 different countries taking part, and there are no fewer than 54 different categories in which to compete. So we'll be joining someone live in Riga to tell us about how it's going.
Sounds like the Invigilator's idea of hell.
It probably does.
Good heavens, I wouldn't like to be in their seat. Sarah, we'll look forward to the programme. Sarah Moore-Peach with The Choir at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Well, next this afternoon, a choral evensong, which was first broadcast live here on Radio 3 from Canterbury Cathedral last Wednesday. The Magnificat by Giles Swaim was written in 1982 for Francis Greer and the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford. It takes as inspiration the music Swaim heard on a visit to Africa, and in particular a work song from southern Senegal. The Nunc Dimittis was composed by Gustav Holst in 1915 for Richard Terry, the first director of music at Westminster Cathedral. And the anthem is William Harris's 1959 setting of words by the priest and metaphysical poet John Donne. Bring us, O Lord God, at our last awakening into the house and gate of heaven. The service opens now with an introit by Michael Barclay, commissioned in 2013 for the enthronement of the Most Reverend Justin Welby, Archbishop of Canterbury. It's a translation of words from the Rule of St Benedict, encouraging the hearer to accept God's guidance. Listen, listen, O my child.